Woman House.
Woman House.
Woman House.
Woman House.
Woman House.
You wish me to be your wife?
I swear it.
You love me?
I do.
Woman House, Agathe Sala.
Jane Eyre is the masterpiece of the English novelist Charlotte Bronte, published in 1847. It is a novel of female apprenticeship, in which the heroine, an orphan entrusted to the care of her aunt, and raised in a family that doesn't love her, gradually emancipates herself through education and intelligence. She acquires financial independence by becoming a schoolteacher, and later wins the respect and love of one of her employers. Yet, despite this path of emancipation, the three excerpts I will read all describe situations of confinement. We enter the novel in two scenes of confinement in chapters 1 and 2. Isolation is first chosen by the heroine, who seeks refuge in solitude, then imposed by her adoptive mother as punishment for a mistake she did not make. The last excerpt is at the end of the novel, when the heroine is an adult. This time, it is not her who is locked up, but she discovers the secret of the man she loves, his secret wife, imprisoned in a remote room of his castle. Jane Eyre's entire destiny is summed up in these three mutually illuminating scenes. First, she experiences the essential difference between the isolation she desired and the isolation she suffered. The first offered her the possibility to escape through reading. In the second, on the contrary, she was overtaken by deadly and obsessive thoughts, fear, helplessness, discouragement. From childhood to adulthood, the different spaces the heroine traverses appear as variations of confinement situations. Real spaces, such as the bedroom, the cell, and even the tightest space of all, the tomb or the coffin, but also imaginary ones, such as the rock lost in the middle of the sea, the shipwrecked boat, the pole locked in the ice. All these forms of confinement refer to exterior limits, those of space and time, as well as the inner limits of the heroine, until her final confrontation with madness, which is both inside and beyond herself. In English, the subtitle of Jane Eyre is Autobiography. The novel is largely inspired by the fate and personality of the novelist Charlotte Bronte, born to a great family, yet haunted by death and madness. Motherless children, raised apart from the world, in an isolated presbytery, now a place of literary pilgrimage, the Bronte children formed a small society, united by the creation of imaginary worlds populated by invented heroes and historical characters. A unique example in literary history, of the four children in the family, three girls and one boy, the first three, Charlotte, Emily, and Anne, became famous novelists, while their brother, as gifted and imaginative as his sisters, went mad. The passages I have chosen are certainly some of the most striking reading memories from my childhood. From the very first pages of the book, these excerpts show the captivating power of this novel. The heroine is an average figure, whose intelligence and physique are not presented as extraordinary, but she struggles against her condition of dependency. This struggle is played out on an interior level, making the life of her soul the true subject of the novel. This struggle is mainly waged in childhood, the age when material, emotional, and intellectual dependency is at its greatest, but also when one's faculties of escape and resilience are at their best. Here, the isolation of childhood seems to be its own remedy. A breakfast room adjoined the drawing room. I slipped in there. It contained a bookcase. I soon possessed myself of a volume, taking care that it should be one stored with pictures. I mounted into the window seat. Gathering up my feet, I sat cross-legged like a Turk, and having drawn the red moreen curtain nearly close, I was shrined in double retirement. Folds of scarlet drapery shut in my view to the right hand. To the left were the clear panes of glass, protecting but not separating me from the drear November day. At intervals, while turning over the leaves of my book, I studied the aspect of that winter afternoon. Afar, it offered a pale blank of mist and cloud. Near, a scene of wet lawn and storm-beat shrub, with ceaseless rain sweeping away wildly before a long and lamentable blast. I returned to my book, Buick's History of British Birds. The letterpress thereof I cared little for, generally speaking, and yet there were certain introductory pages that, child as I was, I could not pass quite as a blank. They were those which treat of the haunts of seafowl, of the solitary rocks and promontories by them only inhabited, of the coast of Norway, studded with isles, from its southern extremity, the Lydness or Naze, to the North Cape, where the Northern Ocean, in vast whirls, boils round the naked, melancholy isles of farthest Thule, and the Atlantic surge pours in among the stormy Hebrides. Nor could I pass unnoticed the suggestion of the bleak shores of Lapland, Siberia, Spitsbergen, Nova Zembla, Iceland, Greenland, with the vast sweep of the Arctic zone and those forlorn regions of dreary space, that reservoir of frost and snow, where firm fields of ice, the accumulation of centuries of winters, glazed in alpine heights above heights, surround the pole and concenter the multiplied rigours of extreme cold. Of these death-white realms, I formed an idea of my own, shadowy, like all the half-comprehended notions that float dim through children's brains, but strangely impressive. The words in these introductory pages connected themselves with the succeeding vignettes and gave significance to the rock standing up alone in a sea of billow and spray, to the broken boat stranded on a desolate coast, to the cold and ghastly moon glancing through bars of cloud at a wreck just sinking. Each picture told a story, mysterious often to my undeveloped understanding and imperfect feelings, yet ever profoundly interesting. As interesting as the tales Bessie sometimes narrated on winter evenings, when she chanced to be in good humour, and when, having brought her ironing table to the nursery hearth, she allowed us to sit about it, and while she got up Mrs. Reed's lace frills and crimped her nightcap borders, fed our eager attention with passages of love and adventure taken from old fairy tales and other ballads, or, as at a later period I discovered, from the pages of Pamela and Henry, Earl of Moreland. With Bewick on my knee, I was then happy, happy at least in my way. I feared nothing but interruption, and that came too soon. The breakfast room door opened. They went, shutting the door and locking it behind them. The red room was a square chamber. Very seldom slept in. I might say never, indeed. Unless when a chance influx of visitors at Gateshead Hall rendered it necessary to turn to account all the accommodation it contained. Yet it was one of the largest and stateliest chambers in the mansion. A bed supported on massive pillars of mahogany, hung with curtains of deep red damask, stood out, like a tabernacle in the centre. The two large windows, with their blinds always drawn down, were half shrouded in festoons and folds of similar drapery. The carpet was red. The table at the foot of the bed was covered with a crimson cloth. The walls were a soft fawn colour with a blush of pink in it. The wardrobe, the toilet table, the chairs were of darkly polished old mahogany. This room was chill because it seldom had a fire. It was silent because remote from the nursery and kitchen, solemn because it was known to be so seldom entered. The housemaid alone came here on Saturdays to wipe from the mirrors and the furniture a week's quiet dust. And Mrs. Reed herself, at far intervals, visited it to review the contents of a certain secret drawer in the wardrobe, where were stored divers parchments, her jewel casket, and a miniature of her deceased husband. And in those last words lies the secret of the Red Room, the spell which kept it so lonely, in spite of its grandeur. Mr. Reed had been dead 9 years. It was in this chamber he breathed his last. Here he lay in state, hence his coffin was borne by the undertaker's men, and, since that day, a sense of dreary consecration had guarded it from frequent intrusion. Bed rose before me. To my right hand, there was the high, dark wardrobe, with subdued, broken reflections varying the gloss of its panels. To my left were the muffled windows. A great looking glass between them repeated the vacant majesty of the bed and room. I was not quite sure whether they had locked the door, and when I dared move, I got up and went to see. Alas! Yes, no jail was ever more secure. Returning, I had to cross before the looking-glass. My fascinated glance involuntarily explored the depth it revealed.
all looked colder and darker in that visionary hollow than in reality. And the strange little figure there gazing at me with a white face and arms specking the gloom and glittering eyes of fear moving where all else was still had the effect of a real spirit. I thought it like one of the tiny phantoms, half fairy, half imp, Bessie's evening stories represented as coming out of lone, ferny dells in moors and appearing before the eyes of belated travellers. I returned to my stool. Superstition was with me at that moment, but it was not yet her hour for complete victory. My blood was still warm. The mood of the revolted slave was still bracing me with its bitter vigour. I had to stem a rapid rush of retrospective thought before I quailed to the dismal present. Daylight began to forsake the Red Room. It was past 4 o'clock, and the beclouded afternoon was tending to drear twilight. I heard the rain still beating continuously on the staircase window and the wind howling in the grove behind the wall. I grew by degrees cold as a stone, and then my courage sank. My habitual mood of humiliation, self-doubt, forlorn depression fell damp on the embers of my decaying ire. All said I was wicked, and perhaps I might be so. What thought had I been but just conceiving of starving myself to death? That certainly was a crime. And was I fit to die? Or was the vault under the chancel of Gateshead Church an inviting bourne? I endeavoured to be firm. Shaking my hair from my eyes, I lifted my head and tried to look boldly round the dark room. At this moment, a light gleamed on the wall. Was it, I asked myself, a ray from the moon penetrating some aperture in the blind? No. Moonlight was still, and this stirred. While I gazed, it glided up to the ceiling and quivered over my head. I can now conjecture readily that this streak of light was in all likelihood a gleam from a lantern carried by someone across the lawn. But then, prepared as my mind was for horror, shaken as my nerves were by agitation, I thought the swift darting beam was a herald of some coming vision from another world. My heart beat thick, my head grew hot, a sound filled my ears which I deemed the rushing of wings. Something seemed near me. I was oppressed, suffocated, endurance broke down. I rushed to the door and shook the lock in desperate effort. I suppose I had a species of fit. Unconsciousness closed the scene. He passed on and ascended the stairs, still holding my hand, and still beckoning the gentlemen to follow him, which they did. We mounted the first staircase, passed up the gallery, proceeded to the third story. The low black door, opened by Mr. Rochester's master key, admitted us to the tapestried room, with its great bed and its pictorial cabinet. You know this place, Mason, said our guide. She bit and stabbed you here. He lifted the hangings from the wall, uncovering the second door. This too he opened. In a room without a window, there burnt a fire guarded by a high and strong fender, and a lamp suspended from the ceiling by a chain. In the deep shade, at the farther end of the room, a figure ran backwards and forwards. What it was, whether beast or human being, one could not at first sight tell. It grovelled, seemingly, on all fours. It snatched and growled, like some strange wild animal, but it was covered with clothing, and a quantity of dark, grizzled hair, wild as a mane, hid its head and face. That is my wife, said he. Such is the sole conjugal embrace I am ever to know. Such are the endearments which are to solace my leisure hours. And this is what I wished to have, laying his hand on my shoulder. This young girl, who stands so grave and quiet at the mouth of hell, looking collectedly at the gambols of a demon, I wanted her just as a change after that fierce ragout.
Woman House is a podcast produced by Aware with the support of Belinda de Goudemar. Directed by Elodie Royer. Original music by Andrew Nelson.